Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to WonderPod, episode 35. I am joined this week, as always, by Gunsage.
Hello.
And joining us also this week, it's a real special treat for me. I've known this guy a long time. Some of you know him. Some of you love him. That's all I need to say. He's a reviews editor at Destructoid.com, Jim Sterling.
I like the little gap you gave, as if you were going to say some of you love him, but most of you hate him, and then decided against it.
Yeah, I kind of fell off there at the end, because it's
very
like,
diplomatic. I appreciate that.
Well, I don't really want to promote your haters. I'm probably going to get called an ass licker for that, but I really don't give a fuck either. It's kind of nice being me. I don't care. I just don't give a shit. I've known you roughly since 2003. Who gives a shit at this point? I don't, that's for sure.
It's been a fair old long time. Fuck.
See, I know.
Almost a decade. And this is actually the first time we've actually spoken outside of text, I believe. I don't think we've ever been on a podcast together, have we not?
Remember, we did a couple station nations that Dan didn't like and didn't ever let see the light of day. I think one of them, you and I discussed mailboxes for like 20 minutes when you were just visiting your now wife over here in Mississippi.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah, It's a blur, the old...
Oh, it is for me, too. There's certain things that stand out, but a lot of it, it was all fun. That's all I cared.
Yeah. It was all fun, and it was all rape and cancer jokes, and all good friends together having a laugh on it.
Speaking of the gentleman you were talking about earlier, he hated the rape jokes. What about the Hitler jokes?
Yeah, well, you know, they weren't jokes. He was a fine, upstanding gentleman, and I stand by that.
I think it was primarily that he didn't hate those jokes. Those were good jokes.
Yes, and I'll give you my PayPal account after the show to have that cut out. No, I'm kidding. joking. Gunsage, save me. What have you been playing this week?
Five games. I'll just real quickly run through them. Darksiders, Torchlight, a little bit more of Scott Pilgrim. Sort of hanging in there with Skate 2. And then the one I was telling you about that's basically the ridiculous Mega Man clone, which is Rosencrutz Stilett. You almost have to see it spelled. It's ridiculous.
I've actually not heard of that.
I only came across it because I was looking at different speedrun stuff. And from what I can gather, it's some kind of... It's basically a Mega Man clone, except it's done entirely with schoolgirls. It's crazy.
So it's a Japanese clone, or what are we supposed to take away from that?
I thought it was just like... They went ahead and changed around some levels or whatever, but it's actually like it's a full game. It's actually longer than most Mega Man games, except it's all like schoolgirls and remakes of Mega Man villains and all kinds of other stuff. It's really crazy, but also really over the top. It's actually pretty cool looking.
Cool. All right, Jim, what have you been playing this week?
I have, because I am a games journalist who plays all the latest games, I have been playing Fallout 3, which is good, because I used to hate it. I first played it, I played it and beat it back in 2008 when it was released, and it didn't grab me. I didn't understand what everyone was seeing in it, I didn't like this whole VAT system thing, and I do confess I did get into it just before the end credits rolled, and then I felt even worse, because then I was like, well, I've just gotten into this, and now the game's over, and I can't go back and play and finish off any of the quests. So that was bullshit. But the problem is my brain would not accept that I don't like a Bethesda-developed Western RPG set in post-apocalyptic America. So in the intervening years, I've tried five times to play this game and get into it. And it wasn't until I played the first Fallout, the original from way back in, like, 1997 or whatever it was, that I actually started to get it, because obviously then I played it and I realized what type of game it was and that Fallout 3 was an evolution of that game. And then I really got into it, and I couldn't get it running on my PC, even though it was running perfectly fine and then didn't because PC gaming. And so I had to get it on the 360 again and played it, really got into it. Finally, something just clicked. And I guess the lesson there is, if you're going to get into a game series, to really know its history. And that seems to help, especially help that I like the first Fallout, but it's so slow. So getting a fast version of that with Fallout 3, like, it made it look better in comparison gameplay-wise. So, yeah, that's been the thing that I've been doing mostly.
And I have to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, it has been amusing for me because on my Xbox Live friends list, it has been Halo, 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 Fallout 3, Halo, Halo, Halo. And it just, it was funny on one hand. It just kind of ironic because even I, which I will get to in a second, have been playing Halo. So barring our argument from 2008, and I had the year wrong in the pre-show, barring the shrubbery still being rubbish, though, you have gotten into the series fairly well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the shrubbery that I clipped through and got stuck on back in 2008 is still a bone of contention for me. And there are glitches in that game that are kind of unforgivable. But then that's true of all Bethesda games, as much as I like the studio. But it's funny, a month ago, Fallout New Vegas could have fucked right off. But now I'm looking forward to it more than anything else this season. And I've been bugging Bethesda every day, like, when's the review copy coming? When's the review copy coming? I want to play it, please, thanks. And so, yeah, I'm really excited for it. But it just is funny how I forced myself to love Fallout 3. I basically forced a love on myself. I'm the victim of my own rape. But it is a good rape, so it is all fun.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, as you know, Gunsage types in the text chat. And it's kind of the same with me. I had that problem with Morrowind. I had to play that game, uninstall it, reinstall it, and play it several times before I finally got into it. And I like Bethesda stuff. I liked all the old, you know, all the old Fallouts and Fallout 3. So it's sometimes just go ahead and, you know, forcing yourself, like you said, is good. I have been playing, well, first off, I played the Vanquish demo. I liked the demo. I like the game. It's a pretty decent little Gears of War-esque shooter. Sadly, ladies and gentlemen, I think it's probably going to go down in the toilet in this onslaught we're about to witness in games. So I will probably pick it up at some point later in the $20 bin, maybe, for fun. Been playing Civilization 4 and getting ready for Civilization 5. And then finally, yes, I know on this show, Gunsage and I make a lot of fun of Halo. We do a lot of jokes about Halo. But Patrick's overwhelming argument to me to at least try Halo Reach made me go and get a copy of Halo Reach on the release date. I went through a lot of scenarios in my mind how I wanted to do this and what I wanted to talk about. And basically, I think what I'm going to say is it's a decent game. For me, it's not even going to come close to my game of the year of games I've played this year. In case you're interested, that would be Red Dead Redemption for me. But it's a good game if you were not a fan of the series, if you were not entrenched in the series. And it's going to sell millions of copies because of the fan base. I mean, it's simple as that. So, you know, I'm not really going to go into too much detail. As I was just joking with Jim, it's our, on my friends list, it's just been out the door with the number of people playing it. It's going to sell millions. I'll probably enjoy it with multiplayer when Patrick gets back from the mountains. So that's really, I think, probably best all I want to say with Reach is I enjoy it. I had a good time in the single player campaign, but it didn't blow me away by any stretch of imagination either. And that's what we've been playing. Now, we're not going to keep... Oh, wait, Jim, do you have something to say? Or...
Oh, no, I was just going to say that Halo Reach is Halo. That's it. I struggle with that series. I did play some Halo Reach, and I've tried several times. You see, Halo is like Fallout 3. I've tried. I have tried several times, and I just don't see it. I don't see what it is. Visually, it doesn't strike me as interesting. It looks like action figures. The story just... Ugh. And the gameplay just feels like something from the 90s. But not in a nostalgic way, just in a this-feels-dated way. I'm a big Killzone fan, and a lot of people say, well, aren't they the same? And it's like, no, the Killzone is a very weighted and heavy and gritty game. And just compared to these action figures... flying every time they jump and feeling like they're made out of feathers, it just doesn't kind of work for me.
Actually, what you said earlier this week on Twitter is what I thought as the end credits were rolling. You said that it just goes over your head And I think I'm having the same problem, and I don't think going back and playing any of the others, which due to my not owning a console until 2007, you know, I never did, I still don't think it would make any difference for me. I've enjoyed my time with it. You know, it's not been like, oh, my God, I hate it. But I think I'm kind of in the similar boat as you, that it just kind of goes over my head, and I don't really get it.
Quite understand it, and I certainly don't want to take anything away from Halo's cultural impact. I mean, for some people, for a new generation of people, this is their Star Wars, and some people like to laugh that off, but that's that for them. And I can tell it's very important to some people, but I just don't get it.
Yeah, I think with the people I enjoy playing multiplayer games with on my friends list, like Gunsage and Patrick and some others, I'll probably get my money's worth out of it. So I can't say that I lost any, you know, value on the deal, but yeah, I really tried hard to be very open-minded when I was playing it and made sure that I wasn't just looking for some reason to dislike it. But yeah, it just goes over my head. Okay. That is what we've been playing. Now, we only have Jim for a limited time because otherwise we're going to starve him to death. So basically, Gunsage and I have come up with some just Q&A stuff to ask him real quick, and then we're going to let him off into that gentle night. I'll go ahead and go with the first question, Gunsage, and then you can ask him one, and we'll kind of go like that until we run out of questions. And it's funny because before the show, when we were having some issues with Skype, we kind of went on a little bit of a nostalgia trip. And that's actually my first question to you, Jim. Now, and for those of you that don't know, I met Jim in 2003 when he was writing at one site. I really liked his writing. I really liked the way he did things. It kind of opened my eyes to other ways you can write, things of that nature. Okay, enough with the ass-kissing. My question is...
You can carry on. If you just brought me on here just to kiss my ass for like half an hour, I'm perfectly okay with
well,
that.
Well, no, I mean, it's not kissing your ass. It's just the truth. I mean, that's what drew me to you as a writer. It's why I still read you today. It's why, you know, I've known you for just short of a decade because it was there and it taught me a lot about writing. But going back to 2003, could you ever in your wildest dreams back then, and even as much fun as we had, see yourself doing what you're doing today?
Absolutely not. Like, it's funny because it never even occurred to me to try and make a job of writing about video games back then. I certainly had just started to see the internet as a viable way of getting a nice career as an entertainer, because that's all I ever wanted to do. I'm sure you remember that I used to work with Leo Van Crinks a lot, working on live comedy. We did some shows and I've done some stand-up comedy in my time. And that was really where I was going for a long time, but until I kind of sat down and realized that I enjoyed writing it more than performing it. And I also enjoyed video games a lot at the time, and it was like, I never thought to put them together. I worked a lot for the original incarnation of Project Wonder Boy for a while, just for entertainment. And even then, I took it kind of seriously. I enjoyed doing it a lot. And then just one day, after being unemployed for a bit too long, I just thought, well, fuck it, I'll just try. And then I emailed IGN and somehow got a little gig with them. And so, no, I mean, back in 2003, envisaged myself perhaps doing the stand-up circuit or being a famous telly guy with Leo. But this is... been better. This has been more awesome than I would have imagined. So,
you know, I get odd looks every time I say this to one of the old Nation members, and I have said it a few times. In 2005, when I left and went to Alabama, where they apparently don't have as good of internet connections as they do in Mississippi, and I was gone for, you know, 18 months, when I came back and I found out that you were working at Destructoid, I was really happy for you, but at the same time, I wasn't surprised. You've always seemed like you had that drive to write, to create. So, you know, when JCC first told me, oh yeah, by the way, Jim's working for this gaming site now. And I was like, you know, he was taken back because I wasn't surprised at all. You know, having been around you and seen how you were really had no fear of writing anything. You know, I mean, you've gotten me to tell rape jokes, Hitler jokes, use words that I never thought in a million.
I don't know if that's something I should be proud of.
Well, I mean, you should be, for the point of it opened up my mind to other areas to write about. You know, there would have been no Motobob. There would have been no Smurfs. There would have been not a lot of the crazy stuff I did because I grew up in very, very homogenized American English classes where you just wrote about, you know, stuff, but you never really went too over the top. So, you know, when you, with your influence on me, it was like, oh, so I can actually get away with that? And plus the internet, like you said, hell, it's the internet. Who's going to see me do it? You know, so, I mean, there's kind of a freedom in that.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been something I'm proud of. I got good grades and decent grades in school when it came to English language and everything, but I'm not a trained writer, and I never, I made a decision very early on that I didn't want to go the same route as everyone else, the whole, you know, go to university and get the degree for the thing you want and then go and do that like everyone else. I decided I'd try and make it out there on my own. So I'm very pleased with that. You know, I hold my hands up and say I don't have degrees. I don't have, I don't even have any grades worth telling anyone about. Yet here I am making what I would say is a very comfortable living, just doing what I love, and hopefully people who want to do it as well can sort of be encouraged by that, I hope. I know I've encouraged a few people, and I would discourage them from trying to do exactly what I do because that gets you into trouble sometimes. But certainly give it a go. That just fucking do it is my kind of motto. I added the fucking so that Nike doesn't sue me.
yeah.
But that is my motto.
Yeah, Jim came on the show the other day, and I got a whole pile of cease and desist letters in my fucking mailbox 2 days later. I don't know what that's all about. Hey, as far as I'm concerned, you did it right. I've got a college degree, and you know, it's like some days I go, huh, in this economy, that thing, all it's doing is collecting dust. That's really freaking wonderful. you know, so, I mean, you can't argue with the results. So, okay, Gunsage, you got a question for Jim.
Okay, so... typically when I think about a job like yours, as far as, you know, going ahead and just writing independently, having fun with it, and then it just, you know, suddenly you're on a gaming site, you're writing, you're making money for it, you're doing videos. It literally, it's like you're living the dream at that point. But, I mean, a part of me is real skeptical and goes, well, okay, but is it all, you know, deadlines and quotas and just, I mean, yeah, you're having fun because, you know, you're sitting down and you're doing what you do, what comes naturally to you, but is it one of those things where you're worried you might eventually be burned out, or is it literally like an actual dream job?
I think that really goes back to the company I'm working for more than the industry itself. I mean, there are some companies, and I won't name names, where the people aren't happy in their jobs. There's a lot of backbiting. It's a very competitive industry, and a lot of people tend not to be friends sometimes. I mean, there are some great friends. I've met some awesome people, but there is a very competitive edge in the industry as well. But in terms of working for Destructoid, it has been a dream job. It's been more than a dream. It's been more than I think I even deserve. My boss Nero and my editor-in-chief Nick Chester are really laid-back, easygoing people who trust me to do what I want. And do what I know works. And pretty much everything I do for Destructoid, I do off my own back. I work harder than I have to, even. I'm paid to do a certain job, to do a certain amount of, not even an amount of posts, just a general amount of exposure on the site. And I go above and beyond that because I love it and because I want to help the site and the company and help us grow. And then the other stuff I do for Games Radar and GameZone, and some magazines that I've been doing as well, that's all freelance, so that's self-employed. So I'm taking on really the work I want, and that's an incredible freedom and one that I'm ludicrously lucky to have.
Yeah, well, see, I was worried because I was like, isn't he pumping out like 10 articles a day? Jesus Christ, they got to be working them over. And it's like, oh, no, and
no,
actually,
I'm
just...
With the Tokyo Game Show today, I did 20, which isn't my record. I think my record's 25. But again, it's what would be considered above and beyond the Call of Duty. I do it because, well, it's that or sitting around the house wanking all day. And, you know, once you've done that, you might as well do a bit of writing.
Something.
You know, I kind of knew when you first told me, hey, join up at Destructoid, join up at Destructoid. So I did, and I kind of got a feel for the community and all that fun stuff, and I probably should do more there than I do. That I kind of had an idea that the hierarchy there was pretty cool people, but when you put that Bud Dwyer video in a Gymquisition with the violence piece, I went, holy shit. Okay, he got away with that. That's pretty freaking cool. Because that, I mean...
That's actually... I've actually got in trouble for something not even half as shocking as that. That's the funny thing. The Bud Dwyer thing, Nero, again, was just really cool. He said, hey, you've got people talking, and you got them to pay attention to your message. Brilliant. That's, you know... That's fine, so long as you don't get me sued, then everything's good. I've gotten in trouble for other things that I didn't even think were that bad. And again, it's not trouble, it's more a case of Nick Chester, and bless his poor little heart, taking me to a corner and saying, right, we got 50 complaints here, or Sony phoned me because of this. Can you please not do that again if it's not too much trouble? And funnily enough, the worst thing I ever got in quote-unquote trouble for was... saying that Madison Page from Heavy Rain had a Down syndrome face. And the point is, she does. But people were really, Sterling. You did what? You expected better from me. Never mind the fact I've said worse than that before, but that's the nature of the business. And a lot of the trouble, I think, comes from just the fact that it's Destructoid and people like to... You know, they treat us in a certain way regardless, and myself as well. But, yeah, I mean, the Bud Dwyer thing was just the fact that Nero sees that and knows what I was going for with it is brilliant, because there are a lot of bosses, not just in the gaming media, but in any business, who won't really understand or get what you're trying to do half the time and try and impose their ideas of how things should be done on you, but... Neither Nero nor Nick ever do that.
Yeah, because I can tell you, I mean, working in the agriculture industry as I've done off and on most of my life, I've seen some pretty brutal things, some pretty violent things, not human on human, but even that, like when you linked it on Twitter, kind of made me go, whoa. You know, and so it's like, I'm going, that'll get the message across. We'll see what happens in the fallout after this video, but that will get the message across. Because every time I see it, it makes me go, oh my God.
It really is it's a horrible video.
Oh, it is.
That was the point, obviously. You know, the point was that it was horrible and grotesque and upsetting. But it did get the point across. And funnily enough, that is one of the least controversial things I've done in terms of people's reaction to it.
Well, I think it's
even
a good...
The people that...
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh no, I was just going to say, even the people that didn't like it, they didn't kick up that much of a fuss. It was interesting.
I think it's a good thing to knock people out of their little safety bubble sometimes. That violence is real, that it happens, and it's so far different than video games that, you know, take one look at that video. Yeah, you're not going to see that in Halo. You're not going to see that in COD. You're not going to see that in Silent Hill. You know, it just doesn't happen.
Exactly.
Okay, my next question, and now that we've thrown the softballs out there, it's really the only one I had that it's not going to start an argument or anything, but I found it a little curious. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Jim, but back a couple, 3 years ago, if I recall right, didn't you, maybe not on Destructoid, but somewhere, kind of defend Microsoft's $50 a year Xbox Live price tag as something that was of value? Or have I got that wrong?
I don't recall doing it. If I did, I was being a retard.
Okay, because I was going to ask.
I will go back and smack my 3 year older, younger self in the face for saying it.
Okay, because I was going to ask, what if you did, and I know your stance now because we discussed the $59.99 thing. What has changed? What has made you just all of a sudden now? Being more vocal about this whole price increase and how Microsoft handles Xbox Live.
I don't recall doing that, but I guess one of the major differences is once you get a PS3 and once you get a PC and you're playing games online for free, I mean, that just gives you a new perspective. And I wouldn't say that the Xbox Live thing is this ridiculous con, because I have paid for it and I'll pay for it again. Probably. Maybe. But I don't know. But when you compare it to that, it's all I like to say is that it's understandable that some people think it's too much money. And some people say, well, you know, it's only $1 a day or whatever. You know, it's only this much a week. And I'm like, yeah, but if you're used to playing online for free, even 50 cents a year could be considered too much because it's more than free. So that's really my stance on it. It's like, I've got no problem with people paying for Xbox Live. I've paid for Xbox Live. If you want to play the games on the 360, Xbox Live is a decent service to do it on. But don't just dismiss the arguments of people that say it's too much money. Because, okay, it is only $50 a year, but compared to free forever, that's a massive difference.
Right, okay. And I didn't mean to put you on the spot. I just recall either in a comments or maybe a forum at like Nation or something where we had discussed it and you had said it was a value. But I just was curious because we discussed that whole Live price increase versus the PS3 versus PC gaming and this and that. But it leads me to kind of a second part of that question. It's my opinion that because gamers buy $15 map packs from Activision, because gamers continue to put up with this by raging on the internet that they're not going to pay and then sneaking off and paying anyway, aren't we kind of culpable too?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Blame the market first has always been a motto of mine. That is the underlying point. Like, sure, have a go at Activision. They do some shitty things. But every time you have a crack at Activision, you've got to look at yourself as well and say, what am I doing to foster this atmosphere? What am I doing to encourage the behavior? Activision in the UK charged £55 for Modern Warfare, both Modern Warfares. Sorry, Modern Warfare 2, and they're charging £55 again for Black Ops, which is games in the UK are used to paying. It's been a while since I was there, but I think £40 is generally the... Oh, no, it's £50 is generally it, and you can usually find them for £40. But the only reason Activision did that was because they knew they could. And they did. And they succeeded. And gamers only have, the same as gamers have themselves to blame when they boycott Modern Warfare 2 for not having dedicated servers. But then you go to the Steam's boycott group and see that everyone who joined it are playing Modern Warfare 2. I actually did a post about that. It was like 100 gamers that were online at one given time who were part of the boycott. They were playing Modern Warfare 2.
Who originally wasn't really
a successful boycott.
Who originally got that screen cap? Because I saw that and I laughed unmercifully for like 20 minutes and how I just knew that's what was going to happen. Same with the Left 4 Dead people.
I can't even remember. I may have seen it on Joystick. I can't remember where I sourced it from, but it was a fantastic thing. And it was the same with Left 4 Dead 2 as well. I almost posted about that, but it was a kind of a case of over-egging the pudding. But the same thing happened with Left 4 Dead 2. And I called that as well back when people were boycotting it. I wrote an editorial piece called Wow, 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 Left 4 Dead 2. And I was like, most of you people fucking bitching about it are going to be playing it. And most of the people who are bitching about it did play it.
Do you ever see there being a tipping point, industry versus consumer base, or is this just going to keep happening?
It's sad to say, but I think it is going to keep happening, especially as we edge closer and closer to the era of digital distribution. Once the secondhand market completely disappears. But I do think that publishers are going to have to find ways of working with consumers, because if you got rid of the secondhand market tomorrow, which is what several publishers would like at the moment, if you hear them, people like THQ and EA who are currently going on a war against secondhand games, if you get rid of used sales altogether, then you're going to have to lower your prices, because part of the reason why games are even bought is thanks to things like trade-in credit and secondhand games. So I think that eventually publishers are going to have to calm themselves down when it comes to prices and budgets as well. Like, I understand that you need to charge a lot of money for a game that costs millions and millions of dollars to make, but we need to get to a point where budgets are not escaping developers.
Just real quick, because you brought up that point, do you think that court ruling on the AutoCAD thing's gonna actually morph into the gaming industry and user agreements, or is it a lot of hyperboil right now?
Well, as I said, because I did report on it, and I said it does set a worrying precedent, but it's not a precedent I think publishers at the moment are going to seize upon. Because if you look at the PSP Go, for instance, when Sony started offering PSP games on the PlayStation Network, they were charged to meet GameStop's prices. Because Sony, for all of their bluster, for any publisher's bluster when they attack GameStop in the press, they need GameStop, and they are terrified of seriously upselling GameStop. Because even though they say, oh, the used sales, everyone's buying used, they still give GameStop all these pre-order bonuses, and they still rely on them because they're one of the only major retailers for games in the US. So yeah, they are terrified of losing GameStop support or any company's support. So I think it would take an idiot of a publisher to bring GameStop to court and try and force the terms of their end user license agreement on them. I don't think it will happen anytime soon. But if a publisher was stupid enough to do it and somehow succeed, then good luck with this industry is all I could say to that publisher. Good luck dealing with a black market that's cropped up and gamers who can no longer take the edge off of their $60 purchases with trade-ins.
Yeah, mark my words. Somebody's going to be stupid enough to do it. Somebody is going to try it. I mean, that's just... There's people...
I don't know. I mean, I think publishers have eyes bigger than their bellies, and they often do things without thinking of the consequences. But in terms of GameStop, the power dynamic there is so strong in GameStop's favor that I think if any company was stupid enough to go up against GameStop, they would be too stupid to be in business at the moment. I mean, who knows? Maybe don't rule it out, perhaps. But I think it is unlikely at this moment. Maybe once digital distribution in the far-flung future is supported enough to give publishers more of a power base. But at the moment, I wouldn't see it happening yet. They might try and change something with their end-user license agreement to really try and sneak something in. But as far as actually fighting GameStop, I don't think that's going to happen.
Okay, Gunsage, give him one more, and then I got a quick one, and we'll let him get off and off into the night.
All right. You tackled a bunch of my questions. But anyway, I've noticed over the past few months, and it seemed to start, I don't know, it could have started before this, but it seemed to start with the Final Fantasy 13 review, a ridiculous amount of people saying, oh, holy shit, you've got bias, and you're just trolling, and da-da-da-da. And I'm looking at it, and I'm going, really? Realistically, I looked at the review, and I didn't want to believe it myself because, fuck, I'm a huge Final Fantasy fan, huge RPG fan in general. And then I played the game and I was like, no, the game isn't bad. No, really, it isn't bad. 30 hours later, okay, yeah, no, it's actually kind of bad. And I'm looking at it and I'm going, yeah, there was the kid in me that wanted another good Final Fantasy, kicking and screaming all the way to the bank. And then finally just, you know, going, yeah, no, it really could have been a lot better. I don't understand why they did what they did. And I'm looking at it and I'm going, firstly, why are you hating the person that went ahead and reviewed it? And second, bias. I mean, okay, what exactly was done wrong here versus anything else that's been reviewed up to this point? And if you really haven't liked the way he's reviewed things, why are you checking out his reviews instead of, you know, making your own fucking opinions? And then I saw that there were several Jimquisitions and a bunch of other stuff, and I'm like, I mean, is it really getting that out of control as far as reviewers in general? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
I think it's getting worse. I really think it's getting worse because time was, people would get upset if a game didn't get anywhere between 8 and 10. Last year, people were getting upset because Killzone 2 got an 8.5 on, I think it was Videogamer or NowGamer.com, instead of a 9 or a 10. Towards the end of last year and at the beginning of this year, anything that wasn't a 10 is now unacceptable on IGN especially. I forget which game it was, but it was one of the more recent games, one of the exclusives, obviously. Didn't get a 10, and people were pissed. And I'm sorry, but that is fucking ludicrous. That is fucking ridiculous. Tens, if a company is giving out more than a handful of tens a year, they're doing it wrong. A 10 is a reserved number. That's something important for a game that really is almost perfect. Not totally 100% perfect, but any problems you can think of about it are negligible at best. And people want them given out by like candy to any game that they think is exclusive or even vaguely good. And it's unacceptable. And I worry that there are reviewers that see the kind of shit that Now Gamer put up with and that I put up with sometimes and think, well, fuck that. I'm just going to write and tell them what they want to hear, not what I think. And, you know, I've got no basis to make that claim, and I wouldn't ever accuse anyone personally of doing it. But I worry that that's a situation we have where reviewers are almost feeling bullied by their audience. And I can hardly blame them. When I wrote that Final Fantasy 13 review and I logged into my the PlayStation Network on my PS3 and had my inbox full of hate mail, it's like, I can see why a reviewer wouldn't want to fucking put up with this. But, you know, it's become a kind of sad bit of the territory, really. There's not a lot you can do about it other than keep trying, and I hope that more reviewers just tell their audience where to go when they start getting out of hand like this. And the whole bias thing as well, like the word bias has become, it's up there with emo in terms of words people just say and don't actually fucking know what they mean. And, you know, it needs to stop. It probably won't, unfortunately. But we'll see what happens this holiday season when all the big games are coming out. I'm sure there will be more fun.
Okay, I've got two real quick. One that just popped in. Which was the backlash worse for? I gotta know. The Assassin's Creed review or the Final Fantasy 13 review?
The Assassin's Creed 2 review was really the start of it, and it's the one that still gets brought up more than anything else. So in terms of long-term backlash, I guess Assassin's Creed 2 is the worst. I compare myself to Jaime Lannister, a character from George R. R. Martin's fantastic Ice and Fire series. He's this guy who killed a king once, which helped people, but because he killed a king, he was considered a villain for it. And wherever he goes and whoever he talks to, that's what they bring up. And Assassin's Creed 2 is basically my version of that king, in that anything I say or do, people will either try and discredit it by bringing it up, or they'll make a joke about it. I was at PAX a couple of weeks ago. I was talking to a developer. I forget which developer it was, I'm sorry, but I had given their game a good score, and he told me that their reaction was, hey, that's Jim Sterling, the guy who hates everything. And the funny thing is if you look at my reviews and you look at my news posts, they're overwhelmingly positive in comparison to my negative stuff. The actual reviews I've given below a 5 are far less than the reviews I've given a 7 and above. It's just that they're the ones that cause the most shitstorms, so everyone only thinks about those games. But in terms of short-term backlash, Final Fantasy 13 was by far the worst. I had no idea Final Fantasy fans were that fucking vicious once they stopped fapping to hentai of Riku. But holy shit. Those guys are vicious. I mean, the Assassin's Creed 2 guys and the Alpha Protocol guys, and even the Kanan Lynch defenders, God knows, I had no idea they existed. They get angry, they get stupid, but the Final Fantasy guys were borderline vile in just their venomous attacks. It was interesting, I'll say that much.
We have two more questions, and then we'll let you go. I got one real quick. One of my favorite things about reading you and reading your stuff on Destructoid and Games Radar and stuff like that is when you do one of those tongue-in-cheek joke pieces that kind of, you know, to my mind are kind of an evolution of the old Morphine Nation, I love nothing more than to see how many people in comments miss the joke entirely and sincerely miss the joke entirely. My question to you is what's more entertaining for you, the people that get the joke and are laughing along with us, or the people that miss the joke and the amount of them?
Well, the funny thing is I get accused when I write posts like that of trolling. But the thing is it a troll when you make the joke so retardedly obvious that only a fucking idiot could think you were being serious? I write to entertain people. That's all I've ever done. I write to make people laugh. And yeah, I much prefer to get positive comments than negative comments. Only an insane person would actually revel in being hated. So when I write like my blatantly better articles, I fill them with such ludicrous claims and just outright falsehoods that anybody with sense should be able to get that I'm joking, and most people do. But the people that don't get it and come into the comment threads and get into fights and end up making fools of themselves, I wouldn't say that's what I go for because it's not, but it's certainly a happy byproduct. It kind of adds just that little extra kick to the comedy when someone takes it seriously.
Well, I can tell you, being an old school from the days of the Morphine Associates little string message board, that is like my guilty and pleasure in life. Because the minute I see I can usually tell by the titles of your pieces and the banner, and I'm going, oh, good. Let's see how many people miss it. It's like my favorite guilty pleasure to go, okay, he's completely just going off here. That's nuts. Like, didn't you do one like a character I'd like to sleep with or a character who you most want to have sex with or something like that? And there were some people in comments that just, you did
one. Yeah, it was full of characters like Kirby and Tingle and
the Kirby one, that's
right. You don't want to have sex with, and yeah, some people just seem to take it seriously, or they don't, or even if they get that I'm joking, they misinterpret the intent behind it. Like, they think I'm making fun of a particular game. I mean, one of them was, I think it was why Killzone is blatantly better than Halo. And, you know, I'm indifferent to Halo, and I love Killzone, but a lot of people thought I was making fun of Killzone. And it's like, no, Killzone was one of my favorite games of last year. I love it. Another one was the 10 golden rules of Metal Gear Solid, where I did rip the shit out of Metal Gear Solid. But I love Metal Gear Solid. It was jokes made. The kind of jokes being made were only jokes that someone who had played all the games could make. Therefore, someone who clearly liked the series. It was, you know, it was, what's the word? You know, that thing where you...
A parody?
Jokes about things, but don't... No, when you make jokes about something, but it's affectionate. There's it.
Oh, okay.
That's a word I don't use often, you see.
yeah, you don't hate everything.
Yeah, because I hate everything. No, they were affectionate jokes because I loved that series. And many of the things I make fun of are things that I actually like. I mean, I mock Dynasty Warriors, something fierce, but I'm actually one of the only reviewers who likes that series. So, you know, people misinterpret or just straight up make up your agendas for you, and that's always sad when that happens.
Yeah, I get your tweets on my phone, and when Dynasty Warrior 7 was announced, you're big, bold, it's out. I thought, Jim is the only reviewer on the known universe that loves that series.
Story of the week.
Yeah, exactly. Oh yeah,
my TGS.
Okay, Gunsage has got a final question for you, then we'll let you get out of here.
Okay, mine is very quick. It's, what's your favorite game of all time, and what's your favorite game of the last few months?
That's a good one.
My favorite game of all time is probably Silent Hill 2, simply because of the experience it provides and narratively the things it does that other games just haven't done since. I think a lot of the time Silent Hill 2 should be held up as one of the highest standards of video game storylines, far more than fucking Heavy Rain. But let's see, over the past few months, I think it would obviously have to be Deadly Premonition.
I'd never thought for the life of me I'd enjoy that game, but I absolutely love that
game.
That's
the magic of Deadly Premonition. No one would think, I mean, when I first bought it, I thought, you know, I'm probably going to get a few ironic giggles out of this. The laughter I got from that game wasn't even ironic. Half the time, the jokes they were making were intentional and worked. But they're wrapped up in this idea that everything isn't going to work. And it's just this amazing paradox. And I gave that game a 10 out of 10. And again, people thought I was trolling with that, but I don't think I've ever been more sincere in a review score than that one. And a lot of people that loved it and come up to me at events and say, thank you for recommending this game, clearly says that I wasn't that wrong.
I'll give you a short or a quick ego boost on that game too, because after you did the review And I think you said a couple things on Twitter. I went to my local GameStop to pick it up, right?
Mm-hmm.
The register biscuit behind the counter, I picked it up, handed it to him. He's like, oh, this is the last copy. He says, you know, we had 10 this morning, and now we have none. You bought the last copy. And I went,
nice.
There's no way. Really? Jim's influencing people in my hometown. Okay, that's it. I'm feeling like I'm being watched now. I mean, it was... I don't know if for sure, I won't claim that your review had something to do with it, but the guy was like, I can't believe this game, like, we had 10 copies yesterday and you're buying the last one. I'm like going, huh. And your review'd been out like maybe 2 days at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly, according to Ignition, the publisher, I certainly helped. I couldn't take all the credit. There were sites like NeoGAF were big on it. The Something Awful guys were apparently big fans and, later on, Giant Bomb went ahead and did a video playthrough of it, so that all helped. But yeah, I mean, according to Ignition, I did very well on it. And there was a guy who works in a GameStop somewhere who said 6 people in one day came in and said they read the Destructoid review and had to see it for themselves. So yeah, I mean, that is one of the proudest moments of my career, is helping the Deadly Premonition to sell and get into people's hands, because that game deserved to be played by everyone. And the fact that Destructoid's logo is on the front cover of the European version of that game is just mind-blowing. And I'm incredibly proud to be part of, to be so intrinsically linked to such a beautiful cult game, to the point where when I was at PAX, people were giving me copies of the game to fucking autograph.
Holy
and I didn't even
shit.
Make the fucking thing. All I did was review it and post a video of it and talk about it, but... People think Deadly Premonition, and a lot of people also think Jim Sterling at the same time, and that's just mind-blowing and humbling and amazing.
Well, it did one thing for me, and not that I get too wrapped up in it, but it reminded me, or gave me a nice little refresher, that games don't have to be billion-dollar budgets, pretty slick and polished to be fun. And that's what that game was. It was just a good
Absolutely.
Time.
All they have to do is entertain. And that's why I gave it a 10, because that game either deserved a 1 for its gameplay problems or a 10 for the amount of times it fucking made me laugh. And no game in which a transvestite police officer cracks you on the head and holds you hostage deserves a 1. That game is a 10 all the fucking way for its ridiculous music, for its awesome... cutscenes, it's ridiculous dialogue, unbelievable characters, just everything about that game, and the fact that even the game's problems and the low-res graphics and the fact that the music is slightly too loud for the dialogue, just these stupid issues, I wouldn't have the game any other way. I would be unhappy if they'd fixed the music. It just enhanced the experience of basically living in a B-movie. And it was a living thing because it was open world as well, which a lot of people don't give it credit for. And here's this $20 game, but you've got a whole fucking open world full of characters living their own lives. And it did a lot. I think it challenged the idea of what a budget game could be, as well as challenged the idea of what a game could be. $20 games are usually considered shitty, cheaply made, quick little wastes of time. But here was a game that I think after I'd completed it, I put 40 hours into it. And compare that to a $60 game that's done in 6 hours, and just wow.
I knew I was on to a winner when in the opening credits, when your car goes off the road and the squirrel in front of your car screams like a chimpanzee, I knew I was going to be entertained from beginning to end. I literally watched that intro like 3 times to make sure that was a chimpanzee sound, and the squirrel's eyes are all huge, like he's you know doing the cartoon double take, and I just went, okay, this is worth my $20 right here. The fucking intro has me rolling on the ground laughing. I mean,
the game was just so unexpected. I mean, you look at the trailers, even now, even the latest trailer they did for the European release makes it look like a very serious Japanese horror game. And any laughter you get from it is just the fact that it looks a bit silly in an unintentional way. And then you play it. And when I played it, I played that, the hotel scene between York and Polly.
Oh, yeah.
I was just like, this is not what I ever expected to see in my entire life. And it's brilliant. So yeah, I mean, if any of the people listening to this have not played Deadly Premonition, just please. It's only $20 at its most expensive. You can probably find it for cheaper on Amazon or wherever, but don't buy it used. They could really do with
it. Yeah, don't buy it used.
I mean, I'm not against used games. I've bought them before, but when there's a game that deserves the support, definitely always buy it new, and that is a game that deserves a brand new purchase. For only $20, I mean, it's a good investment, and chances are you will be enchanted.
Oh, no, if nothing else, you can spend your whole time on the dock fishing. That was the other one that blew me away. What the fucking... What? I'm fishing in a horror... In a supposedly horror genre game. This is fucking awesome. Look, I caught a bass! Oh, wait, and I can eat the thing? Oh, this is freaking brilliant. I'm sold. This is the best $20 I've ever spent. You know, I mean, so... All right, Jim, we appreciate you coming on. Glad and happy to see all your success.
Thank you.
Wish you very much more. Gunsage, anything to say before we let Jim go?
Nope, just glad to have you on.
Yep, thanks, Jim. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Go eat so you don't starve.
Yeah, okay, I'm off.
All right, see ya.
Take care, guys.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that was our interview segment, so to speak, with Jim. We thank him for showing up because literally he did do a lot of work today. And it was funny because when I saw him on Twitter, I thought, oh my God, is there going to be anything left of him when we get him on? Okay, so now we're just going to kind of, it's just going to be me and Gunsage. I will make full disclosure that I've never been a big fan of two-man shows, but Gunsage, we're going to try it. Sound good to you?
Well, we won't have Patrick here so that we can go ahead and do the Paris Tower, but yes.
Nice. Okay, so now that Jim's out of here, we're going to do news notes. It's a segment we started last week. There will be one of them that I will let Gunsage speak on when I'm done. The first one I saw that made me laugh hysterically, it was on, I think it was on Game Politics or something like that. A Sony exec told an interviewer that they've had people request to interview Kevin Butler and they thought he was a real executive. Now, as much as I hate Kevin Butler, I thought that was flat hilarious and shows that the marketing works. As much as I don't like Kevin Butler, let's see, what else do we have? If you get a chance when you're at your local GameStop, newspaper outlet, whatever, I've got it because I have a subscription. The Game Informer covers this month. It has to do with Irrational's Bioshock, the next Bioshock. I can't think of the name. It's escaping me. If you get a chance, at least check them out and look at them. They are very cool, very 40s and 50s, Saturday Evening Post, something like that. If I get a chance, I'll try and do a cheap screenshot for Project Wonderboy, but they're just, I really give Game Informer credit. Yes, I know it's kind of advertisement for the next Bioshock, but still, it's really cool the way they did it. And finally, and the one I wanted to ask Gunsage about, at the Tokyo Game Show this week, they announced that Ninja Gaiden 3 is being worked on by Team Ninja. Gunsage, you pretty happy to hear that?
Well, the first one they did by Team Ninja was pretty good. Never beat it because it's just so fucking ridiculous, but still pretty good. The second one, the last one, it was okay. It felt more like, I don't know, almost like Bayonetta. And normally I wouldn't think that was a bad thing, but it seemed easy, like too easy, I was like, is this Ninja Gaiden or is it just a Devil May Cry ripoff? I'm not really sure what they're going for with that, and I'm not saying it needs to be overly hard like the, you know, original one was, but it felt like there was something missing. It's almost like they deliberately scaled it back and made it as easy as possible to the point that there was very little platforming even. I'm still interested in it, definitely. I just hope that they don't neuter it completely.
Yeah, that was kind of a little bit my concern, but I thought you'd be interested to make a comment since that just got announced at the Tokyo Game Show along with a ton of others, ton of other games. There was one for Kinect that I thought was interesting. Oh, crap. You'll know it, Gunsage, if I can find it. Hang on one second.
People's... I wouldn't, I wasn't following the TGS, unfortunately.
Yeah, I'm trying to see. Gamma Sutra's got it here. I'm trying to see if I can find out. There's one game that I could not believe is coming out.
Oh, is it one of those Galgun or fucking whatever it is?
Oh, it was one that... Oh, Steel Battalion. They're making a Steel Battalion game for Kinect.
Huh. Wasn't that the one $100 Capcom game with the custom? How the fuck is that going to work?
I don't know, but I swear to God, I'm curious about it now. I mean, I want to know now, how is this going to work? And I'll give Microsoft credit. That's at least one Kinect game. I remember Steel Battalion was popular. I neither had an Xbox nor the money to spend $100 on games at that time. But I know it was fairly popular, and I think there was a couple other sequels to it, if I remember right. So, I don't know. I just found it interesting that not only was Ninja Gaiden 3 announced, but also that. So
maybe you have to wiggle your toes to make the thing walk, and you have to slightly buckle your knees and dislocate your kneecap in order to do an eject, and... I don't know. It could work. It could work very horribly, though.
Yeah, but right. But don't you give them a little credit for at least trying something that isn't casual?
Honestly, I would rather have something where you have to walk like a big honking monster and you get to be Godzilla.
Oh, so like a Kinect version of that arcade game I always forget the name of. You know, the one where you destroy the buildings.
Oh, Rampage?
Thank you.
Well, I meant more like... It could even just be a casual game, but it's like you have to walk all slow and everything, otherwise you might stumble because you're a huge lumbering monster. You have to swing your arms slowly to take out helicopters and buildings and stuff, like entirely from your view or something.
See? There are things you can do. Okay, that's been news notes and a little bit of conversation. We're only going to do two news stories this week. Either the podcast is going to end up being short or something. You'll at least get to hear the Jim Sterling stuff, which if you're hearing this, you heard that. The first one comes to us from Eurogamer.net, and I got to tell you, until the Tokyo Game Show news started dropping, this week's news was horrible. But I did find this concept interesting. Now, pay attention. They talked to Take-Two boss man Ben Federer, and he has a very interesting thought about the Wii and Sony and Microsoft getting into motion controllers. His basic concept is that now that Sony has the Move, the Microsoft has the Kinect, you're going to see children graduating from the experience and the graphics and things of the Wii to the experience and the graphics and power of the Xbox and the PlayStation 3. So basically, and he says that the Move and the Kinect will make that process easier and make it more direct when kids get a little too old for the Wii and move on to the to the bigger consoles, the HD consoles, if you like. Gunsage, do you agree with this guy? Do you think that the motion controllers are going to help or are going to make kids kind of graduate up to the next level of gaming, if you were? Or is there a next level of gaming between the Wii and PlayStation and stuff?
Well, it's entirely possible that the Kinect and the Move are going to be, you know, better executed than the Wii is. It's possible. I mean, I haven't done a side-by-side comparison of anything. The way I look at it, though, is they're talking about in the actual, you know, news there where, well, I got a Nintendo Wii whenever I was, like, 9, but now I'm 13, and that's kid stuff. And I'm looking at it going, so, in other words, it's a niche, which means it's still not going to be family-oriented necessarily, because those systems typically do not concentrate on family stuff. I mean, yeah, you got some family stuff, but literally the only, family game I own for the 360 that isn't an arcade title anyway is Viva Pinata. So I'm looking at it and I'm going, it's possible, I suppose. I mean, it'll definitely be better graphics. It'll be different controls, possibly better controls. But another thing to consider is, they're creating new hardware this late in a console, this console generation. And I'm wondering, how much longer are they planning on having these consoles around? If they're going to go ahead and switch out new consoles in 1 or 2 years, is it really worth it to, quote, graduate in the first place? So I don't know.
Right, but he was just talking about older kids, not the whole family unit, stepping up to the next level. But you still feel that way about the whole process?
I feel like anyone who wants motion control probably already has a Wii. Now, I know that there's still going to be people that are interested in the move in the Kinect, but it's also a price issue. With the Wii, that's all included. You know, it's already there. It was already built for that from the ground up. So, naturally, most of those developers already know what they're doing and everything there. I'm not saying you're not going to have good developers with the new stuff, but that is going to be an issue. I look at it and I go, really? This late in the game? I don't know. I don't think it's going to have as much of an impact as they're hoping for.
But you could see it as motion control becomes more common. You could probably see something like this happening with the whole next generation of consoles.
It's possible, yeah. But I don't think the actual controller will ever really die.
No, I don't either. But just his process he's talking about probably has a better chance with the next generation of consoles.
Oh, absolutely.
Because that's what I'm thinking. I mean, as we've discussed on this show previously, motion control is here to stay. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to completely replace the controller. You're probably going to have a couple different devices to use for certain games and so on and so forth. But I think that Gunsage has it absolutely right that this late in the cycle, this concept is definitely very valid and highly probable, but would probably be more apt to happen next generation. You know, kids still playing on the Wii see that the new product from Sony or the new product from Microsoft has motion control too, but it also has, you know, HD graphics and better games and so on and so forth. You know, I don't think there's going to be much movement between the console boxes this generation. But if the motion tech from both Sony and Microsoft work fairly well, seem to be, you know, pretty solid, and carry forward into the next generation, I think you're definitely going to see more of this graduation type process. And once again, to my mind, if that's, you know, if Nintendo can make a lot of money on each succeeding generation of kids, who then at, say, 15 to 17 move on to, you know, something else, well, Nintendo's not going out of business anytime soon. And our only other news story that we're doing this week, ladies and gentlemen, yes, that's right, it's a little bit disjointed, but I'm sure you'll still enjoy it. This came from computerandvideogames.com, and this is also Take-Two CEO Ben Federer, and it's just something he said that it just struck me. He's talking about L.A. Noire here, and basically what he said was that, you know, he was hyping up L.A. Noire, and he said that L.A. Noire has got technology and gameplay that isn't available anywhere else, and he went on to talk about certain face technology and this and that. My question to you, Gunsage, in this day and age when there's really, to my mind, not that many new mechanics you can try, is this just hyperbole? Is he just hyping up the game? Or are we actually going to see something new mechanically in L.A. Noire?
I think from the Rockstar angle, it'll be something new. I don't think it'll necessarily be new as far as, like Katamari Damacy, obviously. I think it'll be innovative in that it'll be something very different that Rockstar has never done before. As far as what I'm gathering so far, if I'm just going to, you know, assume what's going to happen, it seems like they're taking a more adventure game style approach, except it's going to be, you know, obviously similar to Grand Theft Auto, the whole open world, different stuff like that. That's probably what he's talking about. Unless he's talking about, well, it's going to basically be like Heavy Rain, except better, or something like that. I'm really not too worried about it. I'm not, you know, going to jump for joy, other than whenever it comes out. So, yeah, I don't think it's going to really offer so much that's, quote, new, that nobody's ever seen before. Because if they were, why not at least say exactly what it is?
Yeah, I didn't think about the angle. I'm going to just basically go with what you went with. I never thought about the angle of something Rockstar hasn't done before, but maybe other game devs and publishers had. Because it just seemed like to me, you know, the tone of this article, ladies and gentlemen, was this guy's not just being full of hype and hyperbole to promote his game. He's actually promising such and such. Well, I just looked at it as, no, he's just hyping up his game. But I never thought about the aspect of him talking about something they're bringing to a Rockstar game that's never been done before. So that makes sense. Hey, Gunsage, you want to be terrified in a heartbeat?
Okay.
I guarantee this is going to send a shiver up and down your spine. Here's my prediction. L.A. Noire becomes the next Duke Nukem Forever.
It's possible.
It's
possible because, I mean...
2005, baby. They're already in 5 years, I think.
I think they were developing it on the last console.
Yeah, they were, as far as I know.
Yeah, so it's definitely... I was honestly worried Bully was going to end up like that, too.
We should do that on a future show with Patrick. Like, pick the next Duke Nukem Forever of games that are in development and haven't seen the light of day and have been pushed back a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, L.A. Noire is about the only one. Final Fantasy 13 was almost that.
I wasn't worried about 13, because, I mean, I saw what they did with 12, and I'm like, they're just falling behind deadlines again and again. I see what's going on here.
Well, maybe they should have fallen behind a few more deadlines and actually made a game.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, did I say that? Oops.
That's a nice watercolor painting.
Yeah.
You just sit back and watch it do its thing.
That's okay. During the Halo talk, I had the hardest time not going, you know, it reminded me a lot of Knights of the Old Republic and Mass Effect 2. This can't be a good thing. Oops. I didn't say that. I swear.
I still got to get that Lair of the Shadow Broker.
Yeah, I kind of hate that came out now because, well, I'm kind of running out of gas on the Halo single player. So maybe before Patrick gets back and the multiplayer nuttiness starts, I'll pick up Lair of the Shadow Broker.
Yeah.
My save game in Mass Effect 2 is the one where everybody survived.
Yep.
And I'm afraid of screwing that up. I'm afraid, like, if I do the Lair of the Shadow Broker, that somehow somebody will die and then I won't get all my party back in Mass Effect 3.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of dumb, isn't it? It's a video game. You can play it over again. You can go through the same walkthrough that you went through to get all the party alive, which is what I did after failing miserably 4 times. Okay, and that has been your news, plus us making fun of several things. Gunsage, we do have a Wonderstalgia this week. And it's a Wonderstalgia that I think Gunsage is going to be a little bit surprised about as far as my corner of it. Gunsage, why don't you tell the fine folks what game we're discussing this week?
Well, today we're going to be talking about Final Fight. Now, if you don't know what Final Fight is, I'm going to find you and pile drive you into the dust. Unfortunately, you will not catch that reference if you haven't played Final Fight, so there's that, but I will enjoy myself immensely. Final Fight is a very standard brawler. In fact, it is one of the first. It's not the first, but it's one of the first. And it's also one of the very first arcade games I've ever played. Way back a long time ago, when I was very small, my mom liked to do really boring fucking bowling night. And so she would go ahead and tag me along because she didn't want to go ahead and pay for the sitter. And there were a bunch of other kids that were there too who were pretty much in the same boat. So we would go ahead and go over to their little mini arcade they had. And Final Fight was a game that we put in God knows how many hundreds or thousands of dollars of quarters into. I mean, literally, it was one of those things where we would just take turns on it, beat it, and then keep playing it. We didn't even care. We laughed our asses off every time whenever the dude was all like, oh my god, whenever we beat the shit out of his car. It was great. And what really depressed me about it was, about a year later, they replaced it with a Street Fighter II cabinet. And it wasn't that we didn't like Street Fighter II. It's just, that's the main difference between a brawler and a fighter. The brawler is, you have an actual stage, you go through it, you beat up a bunch of random enemies that have some variety, but maybe not a whole lot, just enough to get by. The levels are different, unique, multiple soundtracks, and then you beat the crap out of some crazy enemy at the end of the stage, crazy boss. With Street Fighter, it was like, okay, here's your boss, beat him. Okay, here's your next boss, beat him. it was so radically different because I got used to playing Final Fight, several other brawlers, and that's another reason why I'm so brawler happy, just in general. Whenever I see a new brawler that's coming out, I'm just crazy over it because of Final Fight. If you haven't played it, I'm not even going to talk about it anymore. You literally need to find it, whether it's Final Fight Double Impact or a ROM. I don't even care at this point. I really don't. Just find it and play it. You'll see exactly what I'm talking about. Yes, it's older. You may have to deal with it, especially if you're younger and just you don't get it. You don't understand, why am I beating up a gang? Okay, fine, whatever. But seriously, it's one of those old classics that you need to play. And if you can play it with a friend, there you go. Even better.
The part about this week's game that's going to surprise Gunsage, because as every week listeners of the show know, I'm not a big fan of brawlers. But I really, really, really enjoyed Final Fight. I enjoyed it when I was a kid. I actually had it on Amiga, so I really, really enjoyed the game. It frustrated me like brawlers do, but for some reason, it was just gentle enough, both in the arcade cabinet and in the Amiga version, that I just really super enjoyed it. I mean, like Gunsight said, there's really nothing we can tell you. If you've enjoyed Scott Pilgrim, you'll enjoy the hell out of this. You know, just really go and get it. And the funny part is Gunsage kind of, he didn't steal my thunder, but it was kind of ironic. I first played it in an arcade cabinet in a bowling alley as well while I was there while some friends were having a birthday party. I don't like bowling. I'm a fairly athletic person, but I suck at bowling. I've known I sucked at bowling my entire life, so anytime there'd be a birthday party at the bowling alley here in town, I would go and play in the little arcade, just like Gunsage is talking about. And Final Fight was in there for quite a while, so I got quite a few birthdays where I was displaying my now legendary antisocial techniques by going over and playing Final Fight most of the time I was there. So that has been Wonderstalgia. Now, I was told, get this, Gunsage, I was told by Patrick to do the whoring segment. You want to see the world's fastest whoring segment, Gunsage? Because this is how it's going to go down. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, normally Patrick does this prostitution bit of the show, but I am going to do it. We have a Facebook. It's called WonderPod Online. I don't like Facebook, but if you like Facebook, become our friend on there because it's a good promotional tool, and that's about all it's good for. Patrick also does YouTube videos. If you want to find out some short clips of the show to find out if you can tolerate listening to us talk for an hour to 90 minutes, check out YouTube. Just search WonderPod. We're on Xbox Live. Good luck figuring out who we are, except for Gunsage. Haha. And finally, you can also reach us, and this is normally my part of the bit, you can reach us via email. The email is morphinenation23@gmail.com, morphinenation23@gmail.com. I would really like to thank Jim Sterling for taking time out of his busy day to appear here with us. We weren't joking. I think we damn near starved him to death, which is not a good thing. Until episode 36, I am and will always be Bruce McGee. I am out of here.
Major Tom to ground control.
Wow, yep. we didn't get to kill Jim. That kind of sucks.
Yeah.
We could have starved to death on the show.